Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is November 8th, 2016. It's election day in the United States, and the polls have only just opened on the West Coast as we're recording this. So here we are in this moment of extreme disillusionment with, if not disillusionment, of the core principles, institutional structures of the United States. To hear both sides sort of looking at this, and the intensity is amazing. But if we take a very large set of steps backwards, the major predicaments of the nation and the world will prove to be utterly immune to political leanings and various minor, even major policy tweaks and wiggles because, drumroll please, the world has a math problem. Or rather, a set of related and interrelated math problems, which collectively, in many cases, sum up to equal a predicament. And remember, problems have solutions, predicaments only have outcomes. So this election is of vital importance, or not important at all, depending on your time frame and the amount of meaning you assign to the larger context. Okay, my point here today is not to cover and recover endlessly, it seems, the world's major predicaments, but to get to the question of what we should do in response. And if we dare to, we might even go a bit further into the more nebulous territory of determining what we should be in response. What we do, what we would be. Now, both are valid, so let's start with what to do and see where that goes. Now, here at Peak Prosperity, we often begin with financial steps because those are discrete and doable and also often a blocking function to next steps. If you've got financial anxiety and paralysis, that usually precedes and prevents the next steps. So let's start there and go a bit deeper into a subject we've covered before, local investing. To help us both go deeper and gain clarity on that subject, today we have with us Marco Vangelisti. Marco came to the U.S. as a Fulbright scholar in mathematics and economics at the University of California at Berkeley. He worked in finance for 25 years and for the last six in the investment management industry. Before, as he says, a profound cognitive dissonance settled in, and he took a hike. He's the founding member of Slow Money and in the leadership team of the Slow Money Northern California Network. He's also a founding member of the National Coalition for Community Capital. Welcome, Marco.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So, Marco, I briefly mentioned, I couldn't help it, wonderful story. You've got your origin story. I mentioned your cognitive dissonance as you walked away from a very lucrative position in the financial management business. I'd like you to start there. Explain what you meant by that cognitive dissonance and how it is that you came to walk away.
Yes. So I've been all my life a very dedicated environmentalist and proponent and passionate advocate for social justice. And I worked in finance for a number of years. At a certain point, I had to deal with the cognitive dissonance, and I'm sure this is not coming as a surprise to a lot of your listeners. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I was working for a very well-regarded, very ethically and professionally managed private investment management firm. I was part of a team managing $20 billion in emerging markets equities, and most of our clients, and I was very happy about that, were environmental foundations, endowments, pension funds, in other words, institutional investors, and some of them were devoted and in fact were started for the purpose of addressing some of the social and environmental problems we are facing as a society. Now, we were doing great. We were, in fact, the best performing fund in that category with a 10-year track record, the best performing emerging markets equity fund with a 10-year track record, and our clients loved us. And I remember that particular year, we had like a spectacular return, something like 40% in 1 year, wow, which is for a long-only unleveraged fund, of that size was quite spectacular. And the method we were using was very quantitative. So computers that we programmed were selecting stocks. But at a certain point, I asked myself, how did we generate such fantastic return? And when I look closely at the largest holdings and the best performing holdings we had, those were palm oil companies in Malaysia that had just destroyed tens of thousands of acres of rainforest and had basically planted a monocrop of palm oil plants and also obtained a lot of carbon credits for planting trees.
Oh my God.
And at that point, I realized, wow, I am an environmentalist. I donated money to a very well-known environmental foundation. I'm now finding myself managing their money, and I'm putting it into something that destroys the very things that the foundation was trying to protect. In fact, you know, the orangutan habitat was largely destroyed by palm oil plantations. As you might imagine, that's a big cognitive dissonance. I remember asking the chief investment officer of this environmental foundation, are you not concerned that the money of your foundation is invested through us in thanks in something that is destroying the very habitat your foundation was created to protect? Right? That's kind of the key issue, I think, in finance, is that we are just paying attention to risk and return and liquidity, and we're blind mostly or unaware of all the other non-financial impacts that our investments are creating. And so at that point, and you know, the chief investment officer actually had a good reply given his position. He said, look, I'm on the investment side, and my task is to maintain the assets of the foundation in perpetuity. Notice a luxury that we don't afford the 10,000-year-old rainforest, right? But once we have financial capital, that's what we're trying to do. And I need to grow the foundation's assets enough to cover, you know, its expenses and its operations and its wonderful programs, including trying to save the habitat of the orangutan, right? So you can see that at that point, I had no choice, once I understood how things worked, to walk away from the financial industry and from a very high-paid job. At that, and that was 2009. I don't know if you were.
No, I get that absolutely. And
but that was not an easy time to walk away from a nice job.
No, very hard, very hard. So there's courage obviously involved, which I hope we can get to in a second. In jumping off something I've done as well, we have a similar sort of an origin story. You and I, this cognitive dissonance, really important though. And you're talking about it at your personal level, but I'm talking with somebody who's trained in math, so I have to take this opportunity. Let me run this by you. So let's start really on the outside of this world of investing, and let's imagine now we get to choose. So we're in a world, it's composed, say, of only the most ecologically minded, socially conscious investors anywhere, and they have access to only the most amazing companies with amazing ecologically friendly products. And speaking to this story of talking with the CFO of this organization, let's replicate this person's interests across all these investment funds. So if these investors, if they're all expecting in total, just let's make a number up, across the globe, they're saying a 7% return. If we could just make year in, year out a nice 7% return, we can fund our operations and do these wonderful socially and ecologically conscious things. That's all. We in aggregate, we want 7%. Well, what they're saying, though, when we just unpack that slightly, is that they're expecting to double the size of their portfolio every 10 years, which means the companies that are invested in have to be worth twice as much every 10 years, which, using a few fingers, toes, and a distressingly short series of doublings, we have a math problem that I opened with. I mean, isn't this sort of lurking there cognitively, dissonantly under the entire industry, no matter how socially responsible, which is we can't all be expecting exponential returns forever?
Well, that's a very good point. And a point that I'm actually making. So you're referring to a couple of things. One is what is called financial intensity. The financial intensity of an economy is what is the value of the stock market and liquid bond market relative to its GDP, right? So that's a first good starting point. So we say, if you take, for example, the GDP of the world, in, let's say, 2012, that was $70 trillion, right? And mm-hmm. then you look at the liquid financial capital. This is stock markets and bond markets. So it's not the entirety of investment capital, just the liquid one in those two asset classes. That was $212 trillion, which is three times the size of the GDP. That is called financial intensity. And 300% financial intensity worldwide was the highest number we've seen in the history of humanity. And since then, we've exceeded that. So there is one angle that says how much of the economy or the assets in the economy are tradable and are part of the stock and bond market. And then the other question is, where does that money come from in the first place? In other words, what is the process by which, you know, we had, for example, a few trillion dollars worth of liquid capital in the 50s, and now we have, you know, more than 300 or certainly more than $200 trillion. And this is another point that maybe, I mean, you've done, you made in your book, I'm doing in a slightly different way, but we go to the same fundamental cracks of the matter, which is money is an accounting entry. Money is created in the process of banks and central banks expanding their balance sheet. And this is a very hard thing for people to understand, that money is not a thing, mm-hmm. but is an accounting entry. And as an accounting entry, there is no limit as to how much of it we can theoretically create. Banks create money when they make loans. They just book as an asset the promise of the borrowers to repay, and they create brand new money in the form of their own IOU, which is the checking account that they create for the borrower, and that's how new money enters into the system. And so we have the conflation between, and at a certain point we'll have to reckon this, this, you know, impossibility. We have a biogeophysical planet that is limited on one hand. On the other hand, we have a construct, which is an accounting construct that has no physical limitation, which is the amount of money in circulation, which can be expanded and extended through the process of lending. So now we are in a situation where there is an unprecedented amount of debt, and both private and public, and we have an unprecedented level of liquid assets and what is called the excess savings. They're trying to chase returns around the world. And one has to recognize that the money in the stock market and the bond markets and so on is not as real as we think. And maybe I'll give you one example to make things concrete, so to understand both the process of money creation and the process with investment capital out there in the world chasing limited investment opportunities. I worked for a brief period of time as a consultant for a impact fund that was buying conventional farmland and converting it into organic farmland. It was an interesting fund. I was engaged for a couple of months with them. And they were approached by this financial company in Tokyo, in Japan, called Oryx. They were mostly in real estate, but they were planning to deploy $5 billion into a particular asset class in the United States, which is farmland. And they were trying to invest a fairly large amount into the fund. And I got to talk to them and found out something very interesting. Oryx has a stock that is trading in on the stock exchange in Tokyo, and it's worth about $20 billion. They went to one of the Japanese banks, I don't know whether it was Nomura or one of those, and they basically said, could you leverage us 5-1? Could you lend us $80 billion? And, you know, they were more than delighted to do so. So that process created $80 billion of brand new money. The bank basically booked the promise to repay by Oryx at the tune of $80 billion as an asset of the bank. And they created brand new money on the other side. It was money that now was leveraging the $20 billion they had into $100 billion, now looking for return around the world. And if you think about that, that is the same thing that is happening right now with the purchase, repurchase of stock by corporations. They're using the very low interest rates to borrow money very cheaply and buy back their stocks, right? So in other words, some of the money that is acquiring and setting the price for stocks is money that has been created in the process of lending by banks and could actually go into reverse in case finally markets hit some turbulence and start recognizing underlying value. So this is kind of a big picture thing, but I think it's important for people to grok that money is really a construct, is an accounting construct, and so is investment capital. And maybe to tie the last, if I have another minute or so, tie it to another study that links money and economic activity to the geophysical limit of the planet. You probably know of an entity called the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, is a group under the UN that applied environmental economics techniques to quantify the value that we receive from nature for free. In other words, the natural asset, the natural capital that we're using, like water, land, and so on, the market doesn't see the value of that. And so we tend to kind of exploit it because we don't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And so they went through a 15-year study to quantify in dollar terms what was the value of six externalities like land and air pollution, water, greenhouse gas emission, and so on. And they put a price on it. And what they found is that globally around the world, and this is data from 2009, we were using $7.3 trillion worth of unpriced natural capital in our economic activity, which at the time was $60 trillion. So the overall economic activity in the world in 2009 was $60 trillion, but $7.3 trillion came as a subsidy through our destruction of the natural capital. And that was basically subsidizing both economic growth, which has been, you know, in the 3-4%, and the financial return we collectively get from our accounting construct called money. So those data points, I think, point to the fact that we have to, at a certain point, reconcile the fact that money is not as real as we believe, and that geophysical limits will, at a certain point, assert themselves, even in financial markets.
Well, Marco, I completely agree. And this is the point that money being an accounting entry, that's true. And debt-based money systems are really powerful motivators of behaviors. So more than just an accounting entry, the money itself is driving behaviors. And so you're noting some what I consider to be human traits. One is our tendency to overlook stuff if we don't have to pay for it. So the services that nature provides, that $7.3 trillion, we have to sort of wrestle that into view to become aware of it and say, oh yeah, I guess that is there. And then on the other side, of course, we are consuming non-renewable natural resources, and those are a cornerstone of much of our economic activity. So you introduced the concept as financial intensity. That's the point I wanted to bring up here, is that it's not possible for everybody to grow their claims on the world exponentially forever, because A, the world is finite, but B, what you're doing when you're claiming these things from the earth in the first place, if they're non-renewable, is you're drawing down a depleting balance. There's a principal balance and it's being depleted. Like Saudi Arabia, classic case, right? How do we even measure the GDP of that country? Well, look at the flow of money. But in truth, that flow of money is sitting on a spring that's bubbling out of the earth that's going to go dry someday. And then it's a very different proposition at that point. And so I'm just, there's a larger inconsistency here between our system of money in this world we live on. And that, I feel, is what's coming to a fore here in this moment. Echoes of that in our political system as people are increasingly uncomfortable, but maybe not for the reasons they originally recognize. Your grounding and coming from the environmental side mirrors mine. That's where I started my life. And so I have a rooting in that I can't let go of, that I say, gosh, if we wreck that, what's the value of anything?
Right. And you know, the other thing is another way of saying the fact that we're using $7.3 trillion worth of natural capital every year to subsidize our economic activities, to say that we're treating nature as a business in liquidation. Right. Yeah. We are taking the assets and call that, you know, economic activity and financial returns and everything else and progress. But in reality, we're actually liquidating the very existence, ecosystem on which our existence depends. So those are very big issues. But I guess abstracting from that and moving beyond the narrow lens of conventional finance. So when I talk about the financial system and local investing, I always start from the big picture and say, don't think that your well-diversified portfolio is as safe as it is, but also go beyond the risk and return narrow lens of finance. Finance only looks through the lens of risk and return only in financial terms. We actually need to pay attention to the fact that our investments are actually building the world we're living in. And so if we don't like the world that we're seeing, in part, that is due to the type of investments we've been making. And so the idea of moving beyond the narrow lens of conventional finance and bringing in non-financial considerations when we make investments, this is what you would call impact investing, right? So to say, yes, we're trying to get a return. You make a very good point that we cannot all get a return on this capital because it's too much and cannot grow forever. So at a certain point, there's going to be some reckoning in the financial markets of that reality, which could potentially be a situation similar to the one that Japan is going through, which is a balance sheet recession where, you know, to reduce the excessive amount of debt, you have a grinding, you know, deflationary spiral in which the economy finds itself. So we could see that. And obviously, when there is deflation, real assets lose value also. Right. So there's that to consider. But the other one is, why don't we use our investments to build the type of world we want? And what better way of seeing the known financial aspects of an investment than to invest locally, where we can taste and see and appreciate and feel the known financial benefits of it? And maybe I'll give an example because this concept can feel very abstract, but there is a restaurant here in Berkeley called Gather Restaurant. It was started by a friend of mine, Ari Durfel, and his partner, Eric Fenster, in 2009. And they had, two young entrepreneurs, this big dream, and that was their first restaurant, and their plan was to use recycled material for building the interior, to source organic food from local organic farms and so on. And I've been involved in Slow Money, so I'm all about supporting the local food shed and the food producers that are taking care of the land and the people. And so I love the project. But, you know, from a financial standpoint, you know that 80% of the restaurants fail, especially a restaurant that is started by someone who has no restaurant experience, right? And so from a financial standpoint, I was looking at the picture and say, okay, 80% of the chance I'm going to lose everything I invest in, right? Mm-hmm. And 20% of the chance I might get a good return. But, you know, good for a restaurant that just distributes the profit, maybe 20%. This means that my expected return was minus 76%. That's mm-hmm. basically, if you do the math, that's what I expect. If you go to a financial advisor and say, what do you think about this? The financial advisor will say, forget it, right? Mm-hmm. But I did it in any case because of the non-financial benefits to me. And one is, you know, I get 1% of what I invested every year in food at the restaurant. So that's cool. You know, if I stick around for 100 years, I get my investment back mm-hmm. in food. The other one is I want to feel part of the Berkeley community. I want to support this young entrepreneur friend of mine. I want to support the farms that are supplying to the Gather restaurant. I want to, you know, feel the psychological juju of inviting my friends from out of town to my restaurant, right? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So the fact that we were talking about a local investment allowed me to appreciate sufficiently the non-financial aspects of it, so that I could overcome the strict math and accounting that would tell me this is not a good investment. So I think that perspective should be one to entertain with at least a part of one's portfolio, especially because I wouldn't be as secure about the financial returns that the conventional part of the portfolio could deliver.
Well, so let's talk about that transition then to connect these dots. So you left this world of, I'll call it, high finance, and now here you are. First, how long did that process take? And two, second, did you how much of your funds did you move from that world of what I'll call traditional investing into this world of local investing?
That's a very good question. So here's the funny thing. And I have to make a little confession here. I left my job in 2009, and that was a very large financial loss for me, as you can imagine, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not super rich, so I do have some savings, of course, but whatever return is generated from those savings, it's like a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than the type of salary I was receiving every year or every month, right? But it took me an additional 3 years to align my investment portfolio with my values. I kind of sat on it. I left the job, so it was very easy for me to align my livelihood with my values. Mm-hmm. But I sat on that portfolio for 3 years until I realized I really need to get my act together. And so what I did at that point is I sold everything and liquidated everything for which I didn't have complete transparency and understanding of what it was doing out there in the world, which basically meant liquidating the entire portfolio. And what I did at the beginning is I put it all with RSF Social Finance. It's a wonderful social finance company in San Francisco, and they have a fund called the Social Investment Fund, which is kind of almost like a money market fund. I mean, it has a three-month liquidity, pays a little bit of interest. But the good thing is that it invests in a number of really cool companies and social enterprises and nonprofits in three sectors, food and farming, the arts, and education. And so I started there. And then I basically had to stop and say, okay, what should be my guiding principle? What is my personal investment compass? And I realized that that really started from two psychological motivators for me. One is biophilia, which is the love for everything that is alive. And the other one is empathy. And so the way I deploy the capital from that point is to say, is an investment in agreement with those two principles? And if yes, let's establish a relationship with either the person that is managing the fund, in this case, RSF Social Finance, that I've known for a long time, or the entrepreneur that is seeking capital. And only after I have a relationship and an alignment in terms of values with this person, may I consider, you know, investing. And so a lot of my investments are in local. So I think I have about probably 30% of my portfolio is in Northern California. A lot of it is still with RSF Social Finance, and they invest in the United States. So it's more broad-based, but I have full transparency as to what I'm investing in. So I know exactly who is the end beneficiary or the end user, if you want, of my assets. And I have some things like peer-to-peer lending, and I have some of the new opportunities that have opened up because of the Title III of the Jobs Act, which has made offering to the general public more available. But basically, 100% of my portfolio is aligned with my values, which means I only have one stock that I kept, which is Interface. You know, I don't know if you remember Ray Anderson. He died a couple of years ago. He was a pioneer in sustainability, and he had a very innovative carpet company that was a closed loop cycle, both in terms of material and energy. And they were selling tiles. They were actually selling for covering services as opposed to carpets, and would replace tiles that would worn out and blah blah blah. Anyhow, it's a great leader in sustainability, and that's the only stock I own. Everything else is really outside Wall Street and outside the stock markets and the bond markets. I do own some municipal bonds for projects that I know exactly what they're funding. So if there are some schools, for example, or some you know, upgrades of some infrastructure at the county or municipal level, those are the type that I might have.
All right. So Marco, I want to dive into what some of those might be, but I can hear the question lurking out there for people listening right now is, well, okay, so you walked away from Wall Street investments over to this other universe. What kind of returns are available in this other universe? That is, here's the subtext to that question. Am I going to have to take a hit on my expectations over here?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is, what are your expectations? Because if you believe that there are things called the market rate of return, you might be sorely disappointed. So the
Well,
first question
people
is,
used to believe in those things. I don't know that anybody does anywhere anymore, but keep going.
right? So the first question is, well, what are your expectations? You know, if you go to a financial advisor, you go to an asset wealth manager, they have some standard canned, pretty similar capital market expectation that say, oh, the U.S. stocks will probably deliver 6% in the long haul. Some people might have 8, some people might have 6, and then bonds, well, depending on their maturity, might deliver. Well, now they realize the interest rates have been taken down a lot by the Federal Reserve, both on the long end and short end of the yield curve. So they might say, you know, they might deliver 3 to 4%, depending on which bonds you're looking at, right? International equity might be 6%. Well, that very much depends on which period you're looking at. So if you're looking at a 100-year period, guess what? Those returns are not that high. If you're looking at the last 40 years, they're very high. But I would argue those reflected a period that is not going to look at all like the next 40 years or the next 20 years. And so that's the first question is, when people are asking the question of, well, what are the return available in local investing? They have a preconceived notion of what they think they're going to get from the stock market, the bond market, and other asset classes. And I would question those. In fact, I do that. You know, maybe I'll get to talk about it. I do offer a day-long workshop where we actually cover all these topics. And one of the things I do is challenge capital market expectations and say, you know, after the massive liquidity maneuvers of central banks and repurchases by corporations, you have both the bond market and the stock market positioned at values that are going to deliver a much weaker, if not negative, return over the next, whatever, 5 to 10 years, relative to what they've done in the past. So that's the first challenge that I would offer. What are your expectations really for the traditional investments? And in terms of local investing, the answer is, local investing is so heterogeneous that it's not an asset class. And so the return pretty much depends on your trade-off between the heart and the head when you're looking at a business. In other words, when I looked at Gather, right, if I just use my accountant hat, I would say minus 76%, bad investment, right? But I also did it because of my heart, and so I went ahead and made that investment. Does that mean that all local investments are negative expected returns investments? Absolutely not. There are, you know, a lot of the investments I make will have a positive return, albeit a smaller positive return than usual. I mean, that's part of, for example, in the slow money world, we do mostly loans, and the interest might vary from, let's say, 0 to 8%. But you know, an 8% loan might be to a company that is in a more early stage of its development and may warrant a higher, you know, compensation for risk. But nevertheless, 8 might be okay, and if they do well, we get 8%. So it very much depends on what is your trade-off between heart, mind, and gut when you're looking at something. And in the case of my portfolio, I've gone, you know, whole hog, right? So the entire portfolio is aligned. I have about half of it for which I expect a positive return, and I think I'm going to get it, like in things that are very safe. For example, Northern California Community Loan Fund is a CDFI that has a revolving loan and does funds low-income housing and property acquisitions for nonprofits. They never lost a penny for their investors in 30 years. And I think I'm going to get the 2 or 3% that they promised. Now, in the case of RSF Social Finance, the same. I have something in Equal Exchange Notes. It's a $60 million fair trade company that is a worker-owned cooperative that has been really at the leading edge of what a good business is, and a business that is supporting the third world and doing good things out there. So there is basically a good portion of my portfolio for which I think I will get a positive return. And there is a slice that is kind of deep impact, things that I really care about. And I'm prepared to have maybe a slight negative return overall, you know, once you take everything in consideration. But that's fine because I view the known financial return of that part of the portfolio as building the world I want to live in and build the community I want to live in. And so to a certain extent, when I walk downtown Berkeley and I see the various businesses that I have supported with my investments, I'm actually enjoying already the fruits of my investments now. And unless you're in the positional game of saying, I want to keep up with the Joneses and beat them by a little bit, then your money is really there, not just to see it grow until you die with the largest possible amount of money, but it's there to fund your life experiences and your retirement. And if that's the case, why don't you take some of that now and start improving the very world in which you live and in which you will retire? So that's kind of a very long, convoluted answer to your simple question.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that this wasn't some opposition. You know, the world you came from said, oh, well, we look at return, we look at risk and liquidity, we plot these three things. Hey, look, we've got an efficient frontier. It all makes a lot of sense. I just want to make sure you weren't over here plotting, what did you say, heart, mind, and gut, and coming up with an inefficient frontier or something like that. It's not in opposition to regular investing. It's a different take on it entirely. So it involves what you just did there with that, as you said, long, convoluted answer, is begin to redefine investing, which is something we support at Peak Prosperity a lot, which is, hey, you know, there's the simple thing is I put X amount of money in, I get Y amount of money out. That's what the return is. And you're like, and of course, people have been wrestling with this for a long time. People, planet, profits, triple bottom line, however you want to look at that. But I think what you're saying is that for the people listening who want to begin using their money, they should decide for themselves what they really value. And if all they value is money, it's very one-dimensional, and that is neither truly fulfilling, because let's face it, you get to the end of life and you're on your deathbed, the pile of money you have is probably not going to be much of a consolation to you in that moment anyhow, right? And none are so poor as those who only have money. So what are those other things we want to bring into our life? And so local investing gives us a chance to begin to wrestle with that, and that's our own wrestling, right? What do I really value? So I've heard what you really value coming through, and I think a lot of us would share many things, and we might have some different things, and all of that's good. But this is the other part of local investing that we've heard and we get from people is, God, it's not easy, right? Not as easy as obviously opening up my Ameritrade account, clicking a button, and saying I am now the proud owner of a few shares of IBM. Local investing takes more work, is sort of the perception people have. So is that fair?
Well, let me just get back to your first comment, which is, the efficient frontier versus the inefficient frontier. I would say if all you care is risk and return, then the efficient frontier is the way to go. And you might have to deal with the consequences of that decision in the form of known financial risks like economic instability and social instability and turmoil and maybe major disruption in societies down the line, right? So it very much depends on how expanded is your utility function. All I'm saying is that my portfolio is perfectly efficient. I'm just adding two or three more dimensions to it. I'm just adding some more variables, including living in a nice environment with mm-hmm. a vibrant local economy and good food and good air. Now that is a value to me, and I can make decisions about investing that includes those considerations. So from my standpoint, my portfolio right now is much more efficient than the one I had before, because before I was narrowly focused on just financial risk and return. But nevertheless, and the other thing to ask, I think, is more fundamentally is, what is the money there for? In other words, and this is really key, and your audience needs to have this conversation with themselves. Why do I need the money? Is it because of the positional game whereby, if you buy your 50-foot yacht and your neighbor has a 70-foot yacht, all of a sudden you need a 100-foot yacht, right? Mm-hmm. If you're in the positional game, there are a couple of bad news for you. One is you'll never feel financially secure because your financial security is tied to your pecking order in society, and there is no limit as to how high that ladder can go. And the other thing is you'll never have enough. But if that's not the case, if you're fortunate enough, let's say you're the 5 or 10% of the population that is not engaged in that positional game, then the money is there to be used in some form, whether it's, you know, to leave it to your kids or to use it in retirement or to enjoy life. And so in that context, you're not here just to grow it. You are here to steward it, of course, and to make it last until you last, and to fund the things you want. And so to a certain extent, I see my negative return on a slice of my portfolio as taking a little advance of that retirement cash that I would be using. I'm just using it now, right? I'm using it now to build a community and an environment where I'm enjoying living, and that, you know, will be good for not only me, but also the people around me. But to answer your final question, which is, isn't it hard to do local investing? And I want to look to talk about an analogy. Think about the food system and think about how we were feeding ourselves, let's say, 50 years ago. And again, I understand the role of women and how that has changed, and I'm not harking back to, you know, the good old times. But the reality is that if you look back 50 years ago, most of the meals were prepared at home, and we were much healthier then. We would spend 15% of our disposable income in the 60s in food as a nation, and about 8% in healthcare. Now we're spending, you know, 9% for food, and about 18% of our GDP in healthcare. So what has happened? Provisioning food and feeding ourselves has become super easy, right? You go to the shop, you buy a TV dinner, you slap it in the microwave oven in 30 seconds, you have your dinner ready, you eat it in front of the TV, and then you don't have to wash dishes, you just toss the whole thing away, right? Great convenience, very easy. Like going on Schwab and you know, buy a share of IBM. Fantastic. Now, that had costs, and the costs, as I mentioned before, are healthcare costs, right? It has been really cheap and really easy to feed ourselves. So now we can have, you know, everybody in the household working, by the way. And maybe 50 years ago, you know, one of the two would stay home and cook and take care of things. But nevertheless, the convenience came at a cost. And what I'm suggesting now is, I'm not suggesting that people go from TV dinners to cooking every single meal at home. It's very unrealistic. But one thing we could do is to say, let's cook one meal at home and invite a few friends and turn off the TV, which is something maybe that right now or in the last couple of months would have been very healthy for us.
Absolutely.
And let's have a conversation. And I would say, is that inconvenient? Sure. It is a little bit inconvenient, but the benefits are enormous, right? Because if you go to the farmer's market, you get some air, you select a couple of things, you learn a recipe, you cook it, you invite the friends and you eat it. Not only you had a better social life, but also you're working on your health. And yes, it is a little bit inconvenient. So the same thing is for local investing. I would say don't overwhelm yourself, but you can do local investing starting very small. And the smallest you can start is you can go to KivaZip, find a local either food entrepreneur or entrepreneur that is raising some money in your community, and lend them $25 at zero interest rate. Okay, how hard was that, right? And that's a starting. You could have a portfolio of four local investments with $100, and then you can follow. You can stop by and see how they're doing. You can try their food. You will recognize them at the farmer's market. This is just a starting point. Now, if you want to graduate to the next level, and that's some of the things we're going to be talking at the workshop I'm offering in Santa Rosa on the 3rd of December, is we're looking at another 20 investment opportunities open to everybody, and a number of them are based in the Bay Area. Those might be available for a minimum investment of, let's say, either $1,000 or $100. Some are actually as low as $100. You can actually look at one of them and see if it's something that tugs at your heart, if you actually care about that particular business and want to support it. And then you can look at, you know, the prospectus if you've never done that. You know, the funny thing is that when you bought that share of IBM, you were supposed to read a 250-page prospectus. You know, if you look at the fine lines when you said, yes, buy this share, one of the things, one of the disclaimers is, I have read the prospectus of IBM. And nobody does. Nobody does that.
right? But we are supposed to do that. And so in the case of local investing, maybe you'll get to look at some financial numbers from a business. Maybe you get to look at a prospectus. Maybe you get to look at an offering document. Or in very small amounts, you might just do a character loan. You know the person, you know, they've been around in the community. They need $1,000 to buy a new, you know, bread making machine. You just loan them the money. So it's a whole spectrum, both in terms of the amount that you're using and the level of, quote unquote, due diligence you're interested in doing and the effort involved. And you modulate that.
Now, Marco, this sounds really useful. Tell us, first of all, more specifics on the seminar coming up in December. I think you said Santa Rosa. Just some details so people can follow that. And let's point them to a place they could follow that if they were of a mind to go to that. And then second, what are the sorts of things when you say, you know, we'll be looking at 20 local investments? What's the structure like? Like, how do you look at them? What are the elements in there to give us a sense of what that process is?
Well, so first of all, as part, so the class is called Align Your Investments with Your Values. It's really about local investing. It's December 3rd at 9 a.m. It's a day long in Santa Rosa, and the address is 850 3rd Street. But the best way to find out about it is probably to go on Eventbrite and look for Align Your Investments with Your Values, and you'll find it there. That's probably the easiest way. The other one is go to ek4t.com, which is my website. It stands for Essential Knowledge for Transition. The four is just a number. And then look at events, and there's a link there as well. But so the arc of the day is a little bit of what we've done here, kind of a challenge, look at the big picture, challenge the capital market expectations. In other words, don't think you are going to get what you think you're going to get from the traditional investments, and then develop your own investment, personal investment compass. In other words, what are the things that you really care about? What are the things you don't want to participate with your investments? And then we look a little bit about portfolio management and trying to assess what percentage of the portfolio is prudent to allocate to something that may be risky, right? Like investing in Gather Restaurant. So you want to do that with, you know, open eyes. And finally, we look at a number of opportunities. There are four funds. There are about five or six equity deals and about the same number of debt deals and maybe a royalty structure. I can't remember. But anyhow, there are, you know, a number of things. So we can talk about how do you approach assessing both the financial and non-financial aspects of this. You know, how close are these businesses to what you really care about, and then how would you go about evaluating them and assessing, you know, the level of riskiness and what to expect in terms of return. So that's just the, you know, the practice where people would actually go and, you know, if there's a prospectus, read the prospectus, get some information out of it, understand how to do that, and have a discussion on the reason why people picked something and what they learned from the process and how much would they invest in it if they wanted to.
Well, fantastic. Have you, by chance, does any of this exist in written form where our people could tap into that if they can't make it to the seminar?
What I'm planning to do next year is offer this in webinar format so that we would break the content in individual webinars. I just need to set it up because my website is a little bit old and I need to kind of upgrade that and figure out how to do it. But they can come to my website. There are a lot of resources in terms of local investing at ek4t.com, which is Essential Knowledge for Transition. And if they go into the resource page, they have there are a lot of resources there, including my own story, the one that I mentioned a little bit. And there are, you know, other resources like funds and other articles that I wrote on the topic.
Well, fantastic. And that will be a hot product when it comes out. We have a lot of people, I'm sure, who'd be very interested in a webinar format who otherwise can't make it to Santa Rosa on December 3rd, but would be very interested to find out how to go down this path. Of course, people who've become disillusioned with Wall Street and all that it offers and how it offers it and all of that. So it is time to align our hearts and our minds and our guts and our money. I want to thank you for your work in doing this and with Slow Money, who we've been a big advocate of and had Woody on here on the show before. And want to thank you again for today, your time today, and wish you all the luck in the world with your investments.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Likewise.
Thank you.